From meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at ScaredMonkeysRadio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Alrighty, since we last talked, there has been an indictment handed down against Casey Anthony into the disappearance of her daughter, Kaylee Anthony. It's a story that has gone every which direction, sideways, up, down, you name it, around. And I thought I'd bring on my go-to gal for all things legal, Deputy District Attorney from Los Angeles County, Robin Sachs. Hi, Robin. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Dana. How are you? Thank you for having me, as always.
You and I have talked about this case, and everybody has talked about this case. The Nancy Grace Show is now the Nancy Grace Kaylee and Casey Anthony Show, because that's all she talks about. And that's a good thing. But I'm a little bit surprised, and strike me down with a lightning bolt, about the indictment so fast. Murder, manslaughter, child abuse, lying to the police. I think it was 7 counts or 11 counts or whatever it is. We're going to break it into pieces tonight and talk about each of the counts and the evidence and all of that. But your thoughts on such a quick indictment, because now the clock starts.
You know, you and I have spoken about this before, and one of the things that we spoke about in terms of why wait, which is what we had the previous platform and previous plot of our stories were about, which were there is no statute of limitations for such crimes such as murder. But I have to say, in one way, it's kind of refreshing to see justice swiftly being acted upon. While the case is still in the news, it's not a case that the people who finally watched the trial have no clue as to what happened, because they are now the second generation of people to whom watched the news in the years prior.
Right.
And I think that there's a benefit to actually showing, listen, there's a direct correlation with one's behaviors and one's actions. And I've always believed, and I think you believe too, is that there has been a heap of evidence in this case, actually. While there's not a body and there's not a conclusive cause of death, there is a heap of evidence that existed well before what's gone in front of the grand jury to suggest that Casey Anthony should be charged.
Well, yeah, and that's right, because we've looked at that and wondered what was taking so long, and then we're questioning why it went so fast, because they were talking about, you know, 80 people testifying at a grand jury, which doesn't happen. Usually you just bring the police detective, police officer up here. We call them preliminary hearings, whatever. But when you look at this and look at the way that it's been going, and I personally don't like some of the leaks that have been coming out, because they're now the defense is starting to counter some of the leaks, like a young girl's dress being found, a Disney World dress or Mickey Mouse dress or whatever it was. And then the next day you see Grandma Cindy Anthony on TV with the purported dress that actually belongs to Kaylee Anthony. And it just kind of seems like tit for tat, but we're not hearing everything, obviously. A lot of evidence we won't hear about until it actually goes to trial. But I want to get your thoughts on the leaks. I know there's a strategy behind it, but I think it's gone a little bit too far, and now it's time to maybe bring the plumbers out, tighten up some of those leaks, and let's get down to actually preparing for a trial and taking this and bringing the evidence forward.
And you're entirely correct. And the leaks and the source of the leaks is very interesting. Obviously, cases like this, and especially in a place like Orange County, Florida, I don't know how many people have known or knew about Orange County, Florida prior to this case, mm-hmm. but there's an issue as to who is the source or who are the sources of these leaks. Because now, all of a sudden, Orange County, Florida has been catapulted in front of the media, there are any number of people. So when you talk about getting a plumber, I don't know, when you've got sieves going off at every possible pipe, it's hard to, you know, cover one just to have two more open up.
Yeah.
And in this case, anybody and everybody knows that there's a buck to be made, and we know our where our economy is now. That buck's even sounds more appealing than ever before. And so whether or not the media leaks are coming from people who are trying to strategically use them in terms of the for the benefit of the case, or really just low-level people who are involved in a tangential sort of way who are doing it in order to make money, we first have to separate out.
Yeah, we've seen all the cast of characters, and this someday, and I'm not making light of it by any means, but this someday will make a wonderful book or a movie. I've got Catherine Casey on after you tonight, and I'm going to ask her that first question is whether she would write that story. But the story is far from being over. Mom is, Casey Anthony is still coming up with every sort of lie that she can. The grandparents are, one is testifying at the grand jury. The other one is still hoping that, and we can't go against anyone who hopes for the best and hopes that the child is still alive. But this story has gone with the national media attention to, and I guess my question is, and I'm rambling a bit here, is as a DA, and the DAs in this case are doing the right thing, they're not saying anything because I don't think ethically they should be saying anything, but how do you go with a case like this? You're right, there's lots of evidence, there's probably evidence we haven't even heard of, but this is also a monster media case too.
Monster media cases always have the potential of exploding. This case, to me, in terms of media attention, is probably most similar to the Drew and Stacey Peterson case. Lacey and Drew Peterson case. Lacey and Scott Peterson case, excuse me. I'm getting my Petersons confused.
Yeah, okay.
I had suspected back, several years back that that case, even without finding the body at that time that they actually ended up doing it prior to an indictment, that they would have gone forward in that case based on the evidence that they had in that case. And fortunately for the prosecutors, they ended up having the body and they didn't end up in bodies, and they did not end up needing to do or prosecute the case as a no-body type of case. But I think that the facts of the case were pure. The prosecutors removed themselves from the media spotlight. They didn't make huge paint stroke declarations out in the media where you've seen that happen. I mean, in the Duke case, probably one of the prolific examples of prosecutors going out there and having personal vendetta, making statements, I'm not only going to show that they're not guilty, or rather that they're guilty, I'm going to show that they absolutely positively committed these crimes, thus heightening the standard of proof. You haven't heard anything except for talking heads put the pieces of evidence together, and hopefully if the jurors have half of the brains that the talking heads do, and I'm sure that they'll probably have more, that we will see that the evidence is just there. And so there's not that much. The media can do whatever and say whatever they want, but when you have DNA, you have the odor of decomposing bodies, when you have stories that don't match, when you have a father testifying against their daughter making statements, when you know the type of fallacious liar that Casey Anthony is, I just can't imagine any other plausible, reasonable, viable defense in this case other than that she killed or had something to do with the missing Anthony.
Yeah, there's lots of speculation going around now, and if you're just tuning in, Deputy District Attorney from Los Angeles County, Robin Sachs, is here, and we're analyzing the indictment of Casey Anthony. Robin, when you talk about indictments and grand juries, my audience is a smart audience. They understand the court process and everything that's going on, but all you have to do is watch some of the cable shows, and I'm not saying their viewers or listeners aren't smart, but they don't understand the system. In fact, I heard a couple of callers call into talk shows, Nancy Grace, for example, thinking that all of a sudden Casey has been convicted, and they're wondering how much time she'll get. Let's talk about the grand jury process and the indictment process and what's next.
Well, it's interesting. Most states and throughout the United States actually use the indictment grand jury process. Actually, in Los Angeles, we do not. We use a process where we file by complaint. And what basically is the difference is that if you file by grand jury indictment, it's that a panel of jurors to sit for a period of usually a year, listen to evidence. It's not where there's some exceptions to hearsay rules and some latitude, or, and people would argue, a lot of latitude given in terms of whether or not there is sufficient evidence to warrant the charging of particular crimes against a defendant. In Los Angeles, or in California, many jurisdictions do filings by complaints, which means that they get filed on by prosecutorial discretion. The prosecutor is the sole decision maker as to whether a case will be filed. But then a case is brought within 10 court days to a judge to determine whether or not there is enough evidence to hold the defendant to answer to the charges against them. Now, I wrote a blog at one point, and I did get some responses that basically said the grand jury process is less than honorable, and, you know, you can indict a ham sandwich, I believe, is one of the comments that someone left me. And I don't work in the grand jury system, and I know there is a lot of latitude. However, I mean, if you don't have it in the grand jury arena, and we don't hear about the cases that don't make it to the grand jury arena because those are the ones that don't get charged, then you don't have a case.
I think it was a chief justice of a state court or superior court or somewhere that used the term jokingly or whatever as far as indicting a ham sandwich, but there's more to it than that. When you have to look at something, you know, some will call it the preponderance of the case or whether or not there's sufficient evidence to proceed. They're not going to put everything on the table at the grand jury. There's probably a lot more that we don't hear of, but obviously the little girl hasn't been found. The body hasn't been found, assuming that she is dead, and we have to look at that assumption. But how important is that body to that case?
There are many, many cases that are tried, prosecuted, and convicted, people convicted for murder without there ever having been a body. And I think that basically this is a case that's going to require some people to string testimony together to be able to make sense of the facts that are in front of us. The reality is that we have had a nationwide search that has been going on since, I believe, the beginning of July at this point.
Something like that,
somewhere around there. So we're talking in 6 months where we've had all sorts of cooperation from all kinds of law enforcement. There's no lack of media attention on this case. And if Kaylee Anthony was out there to be found, she would have been found at this point. And if there was a question as to what happened to her, then there wouldn't be an indictment. But let's look at the facts that we do know. And the facts that we know, if you put all those facts together and take away the fact that there's no body, it's as clear as day. And I've said this before, if it quacks like a duck, walks like a duck, looks like a duck, it's a duck. The fact of the matter is that you've got a decomposed smelling body. You have a lying, pathological liar. She has not one person, Kaylee Anthony, not one person have I seen to date come to her side and come to her, to vouch for her credibility. That can even say, you guys have it all wrong. Not her mother, not her father, not her brother, not her friend, not her boyfriend. Not one person can say, you know what, you guys have it wrong. This is what happened. There is no plausible other answer. And if you have two versions of a story, and one that's plausible and one that's not, you are instructed by law to accept the version that is plausible.
And plausibility is a big factor. Finding a jury that won't be, I hate to use the word tainted, but if you're the defense lawyer, I'm sure that they'll be looking for some sort of change of venue. But really, there has been just total saturation as far as coverage goes on this case. I know some of the show hosts will say no, but it's difficult not to look anywhere and be able to see something about this case. How is that going to affect things?
Well, there's three points that happens when there's a case that gets media attention. One is, you have to be concerned about the jurors that never have heard about this case. Where have they been? Who are those people? how do they not know about what's going on? So then you have to kind of wonder, are they the kind of people you want on a jury, whether you're a prosecutor or a defense attorney? Do they have enough intelligence, smart, wherewithal to be able to make a decision in terms of a case like this? Then the next question is, you know, then you have the people who wish and want to be on jurors, jury, so that they can write their book, that they can make their next movie. They have impurient issues, so they're going to say whatever they're going to say, knowing darn well what's going on, and they have their own personal motives. So that's the next issue. And then you have people who actually are there who have been wronged by law enforcement or wronged by the justice in some way, and have their personal desire, or just as much as we have the concern for the prosecution in terms of, are we going to convict her because we know all about the case? But we also have the reverse of that is, are we going to be in a situation that because of whatever wrongs or misgivings and misdoings that have been done before, are you going to have someone acquitted, you know, to make up for all of society's injustices?
And Robbins,
at the end of the day, is those issues affect every jury pool. You can move venues, you can do whatever you want. To me, that's just making prosecutors and defense attorneys jump through hoops, and if that's what they wish to do, that's a way, you know, that's one way to do it. I don't know that it's necessarily going to make that much of a difference.
Robin Sachs is here. She's a assistant district attorney in Los Angeles County. Let's turn the page here a little bit and talk about, because I haven't had you on the show for a little while, Orenthal James Simpson. All the lawyers I've talked to, you included, whether they're defense lawyers or DAs or investigators or police officers or whatever, we were all skeptical a little bit about the case. There was the Nevada aspect to it. If, you know, you do something in Nevada, you'll probably stay in jail in Nevada thing. But if I remember correctly, you were one of the ones that didn't think OJ was going to go down for this, or am I wrong?
Well, I have been having my share of crow sandwiches, I will admit. However, I haven't had plenty of them, because I did think that he was going to get convicted of some of the charges. Yeah. My feeling, knowing, because of, for nothing else than the Nevada factors, I figured that we would have a split the baby type of scenario where he would get convicted of some and acquitted of some, because that would be a nice, easy, it's kind of like being a teacher. If you give B's, no one really complains, you know, what's easy with a B, right?
Right.
You can't say that anything's wrong. No, you probably deserved an A. And that was kind of the my guess as to what was going to happen. And the fact that he was convicted of all the charges was surprising to me. It was not a case that I would have wanted to go, take to trial, because I thought that there were some difficulties. But yeehaw, Nevada.
Mm-hmm. The 13-year anniversary, I believe it was, from the time he's acquitted till the time he's convicted, and the jury staying late to do it. Some of the pundits that have been on my program were trying to tie the two together. I think myself that there was more evidence to this case than what we think. Yeah, there was a cast of shady characters testifying for the prosecution and the defense, but when you get into cases like this, you don't get choir boys involved. They're usually bad guys on both sides.
That's true. I didn't have an issue with the shady characters on both sides, because that does happen all the time, as you and I both know. I mean, gang cases and all kinds of cases. You know, you have sexual assault cases that a victim is a prostitute. So there's all kinds of cases in which your victim is less than perfect, or your defendant is, when your witnesses are less than perfect.
Right.
But what I was concerned about in this case was potential legal hang-up. And that was in terms of the ownership of the property.
Right.
To me, it's hard, you know, in terms of theft cases, to be able to secure a conviction in a case where someone may have had rights or ownership to property at one time and then may have lost those rights or ownership. It is something that people have to grapple with, and it's a high-level concept. And if they wanted to find a place to find reasonable doubt, the law in that area is gray enough that it could have been a place, and that was what my concern was.
Before I let you go, a project that you're involved in, besides being an assistant DA, an author, television commentator, you name it, lecturer, You lecture both the Sheriff's Department and LAPD, but you're also doing some radio work, and it's called Justice Interrupted, and I think it's a fantastic job that the three of you gals are doing, Stacey Dietrich, yourself, and Susan Murphy Milano. For my audience members that don't know what Justice Interrupted is, tell us a little bit about it.
Justice Interrupted is basically, from a personal point of view, it's three people who are involved in the criminal justice system. All of us have different expertise. We're the detective, the DA, the crime violence expert, who come together to basically look at cases, raise media attention, and provide resources to people in which crime has interrupted their life. And basically, our mission is to be the one-stop shop for victims, for advocates, for witnesses, to be able to know that they can get reliable information, get adequate media attention, and be able to come to us to help put victims on a path where they're going to actually be heard and get their rights met.
Get their voice out there, and I think we've dubbed you guys Charlie's Angels. Robin Sachs, L.A. County Assistant District Attorney, you're always welcome on the program, ma'am.
Thank you, Dana. Have a good night. Thank you.
Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right, we're going to take a break, and we'll be right back here on The Dana Pretzer Show.
It's The Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. And now back to the show.
Okay, we're back. Author Catherine Casey is here with us this evening. It's always great to have Catherine on the show with us. She has a new book, A Descent into Hell, the true story of an altar boy, a cheerleader, and a twisted Texas murder. And you'll see the link to how to buy this book on the web page and on our show notes. And Catherine, welcome back.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Before we get into the book, and it's a fascinating book, and it's a story that we hear more and more of, whether it's in Texas or whether it's in Timbuktu, we hear these tragic stories, and there's always a fascinating angle to them that authors like you must sit back and say, yes, yes, yes. I want to ask you a little bit about, and we're covering here quite extensively on my program, the Kaylee Anthony and Casey Anthony case and the whole tragic story down in Orlando. And I want to ask you, as an author, when you look at the story, and a story is never really over because the child hasn't been found, may not be found, all that sort of stuff, what do you look at when you see a story like that and you decide whether or not you're going to write about it?
Well, personally, I look for stories that are not so overexposed in the media.
Good idea.
I'm looking for something that's a little more unusual. I think we can get into kind of information overload on some of these cases. That hasn't happened yet with this case, but down the road it may. That case is an awfully interesting one, though, I have to admit that.
It's the public fascination. Some would say it's a ghoulish fascination for these types of stories. And a question I always ask authors, and I've probably asked you this question, there's something, there's that hook, there's that catch, there's that phrase, there's that picture, there's something. You know, when you see your new book, it's in front of me again, called Descent into Hell, and you pick it up, gee, I wonder if I'd like this book, The True Story of an Altar Boy, a Cheerleader, and a Twisted Texas Murder. Damn right, I'm going to like this book. Let's take a look at it. What's that catch phrase that you have in order to get someone to buy the book, read the story, listen to the article, whatever?
Well, to me, and Dana, it almost has to go beyond the case itself. It has to be universal in some sense. This particular case I chose because it involves three young people of college age at the University of Texas who came from great families.
Right.
And this is a horrible, terrible murder. And the question is, how could it have happened and why? And why do these kids?
You know, just looking at the news for the last little while or the last few months or the last year or whatever, we see a lot of college murders. We see a lot of campus rapes, a lot of violence on school campuses. I have children in university, and it makes you a bit nervous. It makes you wonder just really what's going on. But there's a bigger angle than just that. There's this whole relationship angle. You know, it's a death wish through love. That's my term. Am I that wrong?
No, I think that's true in some ways. I think very often people stay with someone knowing that they're in, or in situations where they should know that they're putting themselves in danger.
Something that always catches my eye, and I'm looking at Jim Bergman in the book, and he looks like a dedicated law enforcement officer. We all say we're dedicated law enforcement officers, but there's that one case, that one file that you're working on that you grab onto, and you just can't get it right until you got it right and somebody goes to jail. Let's talk a little bit about Jim Bergman.
Jim is an investigator for the DA's office in Austin. This happened in Austin, Texas. And he's a Vietnam vet. He's spent his life in law enforcement. And he got involved in this case along with a couple of the detectives at the Austin Police Department. And it was a tough case to work. Just walking in, this was a horrible murder scene. And walking into that murder scene that night, they became kind of galvanized on this case. It was, as you said, it was one of those cases they couldn't put out of their minds. They had to solve it. They had to find justice and closure.
You know, there's a stigma or a falseness about these cases when you see murders, rapes, abductions, things like that. It's almost a socioeconomic thing where, well, those are good people. Those are people that were living fine. They had nice houses, nice cars, were going to prestigious schools where, you know, people will say, you mean they weren't on welfare, they weren't drug addicts, they weren't this, they weren't that. All you have to do is look at the Menendez case from years back to see that it's not always the poor person that gets into a jackpot like this.
Well, in this particular case, Colton Petaniak, the young man in the book, was a National Merit Scholar finalist. He came from a wealthy Little Rock, Arkansas family. He's absolutely brilliant. He had the world ahead of him. His teachers, he had private school education all the way through. He'd been led a very privileged life. And left Little Rock for Austin, and everyone assumed he'd be the next Donald Trump. I mean, there were great hopes for this kid. And within 2 years at UT, he had totally trashed his life, and he was bringing everybody else down with him.
No, we don't want to give away all the book. Obviously, we want people to go out and pick up the book. It's, again, called A Descent into Hell, and look for the link on the show notes to how to buy it. It's from HarperCollins, and, of course, CatherineCasey.com is another place where you can find the book. But when you take a story like this, Catherine, and, you know, you as an author, just like an investigator, you have to put the pieces together and put it into a package that makes sense. How do you do that, and what's the average period of time? You don't write a book in a day, obviously.
Oh, no. Would be nice.
Yeah, wouldn't it?
It takes me about a year, Dana. I don't know if this is unusual. I haven't talked to other true crime writers, but I'll end up doing about 100 interviews for a book.
Good for you.
And I pick up just little bits and pieces of information all over the place, and in the end, I put them all on index cards and shuffle them into order. And it's amazing what happens when I do that, because the lives of these people just fit together, as you said, like pieces of the puzzle. And pretty soon it all starts to make sense.
I tell investigators that are working on cases that come to me for guidance, I think of W5, who, what, where, when, and why. If you can answer those five W's, you're going to have a pretty good piece of the pie. You're going to be able to not have everything. There might be a corner missing or something, but those five W's are so important. What do you think?
Oh, I think they are, and I think why is often the hardest one to fill in, to really understand. And often you have to really understand who in order to figure out why, because you really need the background of these people to understand who they were coming into this event, where they came from, and to be able to understand why they did the thing that they did. Because sometimes, like in this Anthony case, that'll be interesting. Sometimes there's this, this just disbelief that anybody could murder a child. I'm not saying that Kaylee was murdered, but
right.
if it turns out that Casey Anthony murdered her little girl, the question is, why did that happen? What was it about Casey going back into her past that led her to do that?
You know, and you, my next question, and you're such a good author, you've kind of read my mind a little bit, is you can't make everyone happy when you write a book. You try to be fair and objective. You do that also as an investigator, and I think of the Anthonys. They've been vilified. Allegedly, something has happened to their granddaughter, Kaylee. I've talked to Cindy and George Anthony many times, and there's just no right words to say to them, like, how are you doing? Or how do you feel? That's dumb. Obviously, they're devastated, but when you take a book, including your book, obviously there were families and people that you had to interview. How do you stay objective? Because there's certain sides, I'm sure, that want you to write things one way, and the other side wants you to write things another way.
Well, you just like the investigator does, like the police officer, you have to stay with the truth. You know, you plot out what really happened, who these people really were. And as long as you stay with that, really, no one can complain.
When you talked to the witnesses and to the people involved in this case, and you say that you're writing a book, the cooperation obviously has to be a part of it, but how do you judge after the fact when you listen to the recording or go over your notes or what you've written down as to what you think will fit well into the book to what won't fit well?
Well, you know, you look at when you're piecing that puzzle together, you're looking for matching notches, and you have to look at what a specific person is telling you and see how it fits in with what you've heard from everyone else. And if it fills in a piece of the puzzle and it fits with what everyone else is telling you so that there's the expectation that it's true, then it usually ends up in the book. Unless, of course, you're getting it from so many places that you only end up using it from one or two. But it's a matter of kind of remembering that at the end you have to have the entire picture, that all of those little pieces have to join together to tell the story, to really illustrate what really happened in a case.
What are you working on now?
I'm working on the David Temple case in Houston. It's a Scott Peterson type case.
Mm-hmm.
It's really a fascinating one. It took the, you know, you talked earlier about detectives working on a case and that there's one that they can't get rid of or can't let go of, and This murder took 8 years to bring into a courtroom, and there are a couple of detectives here in Houston that worked on it tirelessly during that time, always going back to it when they had time, always following through whenever there was a new forensic technique they thought might help. It was the murder of a young woman named Belinda Temple, a beautiful young woman, a school teacher, who was 8 months pregnant, the mother of a three-year-old boy who was found in the master bedroom closet of her home, shot through the head with a shotgun. And the main suspect for those 8 years was her husband, who was a respected coach, a star football player in Texas, high school and college.
Catherine, why does the public have such a fascination with these cases, these high-profile cases? Are we just all that ghoulish, or is it just a human nature to want to know, to, you know, read the detective novel, to watching a crime show on television, to hopefully listening to my program, to doing, you know, it seems natural. You can't just write about birds and butterflies all the time. There's some real-life stuff happening out there.
Well, it does, and part of it, everyone, you know, a lot of people say, well, it's like driving down the highway and, you know, rubbernecking at an accident.
Right.
And driving by and feeling glad that you're not the one, with Ben Fender or the one being taken away in the ambulance. And I believe there is some of that. I believe another part of it, though, is that most of us really would never do these things. You know, they always say that anybody could take a life, anybody could kill, and I think that's probably true, but the circumstances for most of us would have to be defense, self-defense.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Or the defense of a loved one. And we're kind of fascinated, or not fascinated, maybe not the right word, but we're very curious about the type of people who will do it indiscriminately. The people I write about usually are narcissists, or they have some type of a personality disorder, or they're psychopaths. I have a book coming out this fall. It's actually a reissue of my first book on a serial rapist named James Bergstrom, who's a psychopath.
Mm-hmm.
So there are people who are very, really out of the ordinary. And I think we're curious about these individuals and how they end up that way, and whether or not it's, you know, the old argument about whether or not it's a bad seed, or whether or not it's environment, upbringing.
Well, I think it's completely natural, and our fascination, my own included, will continue on as long as we have good authors like you. The book is A Descent into Hell. The author is Catherine Casey. She's also a contributor to the Women in Crime blog. Thanks for joining us, Catherine.
Thank you, Dana. I enjoyed it very much.
Okay, we'll talk soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's author Catherine Casey. And again, check out the Women in Crime blog and check out the book, A Descent into Hell. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back in just a minute here on Scared Monkeys Radio. Okay, we're back, and I thought I would break in to that PSA with news that I have Leonard Padilla, bounty hunter, on the line with me to give us an update on the Anthony case. Leonard, I hear that there may be more physical evidence, some body fluids on a bag.
There was Kaylee's body fluids on a bag that was in the trunk of the car that held leftover pizza.
How do we know that this was Kaylee's body fluids, I should say?
The DNA reports from the FBI, some of which are in the official reports and some of which are in, you know, just unofficial statements.
Okay. Now, so the whole pizza thing, let's go back to that a second, where Cindy Anthony was talking about a bag of pizza. There was actually a bag of pizza.
Right. Here's the situation. On the night of the 18th, the wee hours of the 19th of June.
Okay.
Casey's phone shows four phone calls to different pizza parlors.
Okay.
In the area of Tony's apartment complex. Now, mind you, this is 2 days after she left on the evening of the 15th, left the residence. It's also the same evening that she was backing the car into the garage at her folks' house.
Right.
Same day she supposedly borrowed the shovel. So now, the night of the 18th, wee hours of the 19th, there's four calls. The fourth pizza parlor does deliver pizza to Tony's apartment.
Okay.
The leftover pizza normally from an apartment complex goes into a garbage bag.
Sure.
Into the garbage bin. However, Casey puts it in the trunk of the car. The purpose of it is to, in my opinion, mask what is starting to become an odor of Kaylee's body.
Okay.
If anybody says anything, she says, "Oh, I got some leftover pizza in there." The maggots that form on the side of the bag are because the bag, in movement around the trunk, come in contact with the decomposing body. In Florida, when you've got the temperatures that you got, and you can map out the weather in those days of June,
mm-hmm.
you will see that it is probably creating an oven effect in the trunk of that car.
Sure.
Therefore, the body is decomposing at a very rapid rate, causing a breakdown, causing fluids, causing maggots on the side of the bag. Maggots, you can put pizza in a bag, let it sit out there till hell freezes over. You're not going to have maggots in it.
Right.
But if you have body remains breaking down, the bag being up against the body, in case somebody says, "What's that smell?" "Oh, I got some pizza." Now, the fluids are up against the bag. You've also got maggots coming from the body to the fluids on the bag.
Who found the bag? How was the bag recovered?
The bag on the 15th of July when George and his wife Cindy went to the storage yard,
right,
George goes to the car and says to the gentleman that's about to open the trunk, and you can look, it's in the reports, I'm afraid that I'm going to find my daughter and granddaughter in it, because he smells
right
what he knows to be from past experience as a homicide detective in Ohio,
right,
that it's a decomposing body. The gentleman that opens the trunk says, oh, this is, smells just like the car where the guy committed suicide and was in there for 5 days.
Yep.
So we know that we have two people that know what a decomposing body smells like.
Absolutely.
They open the trunk, and there's this bag, maggots, flies. The gentleman from the storage yard picks it up,
mm-hmm,
and walks over to where the bin is.
Yep.
Throws it over the fence towards the bin.
Okay.
George closes the trunk, they go about finishing their business, and he drives off with the car. That evening, when it comes to the awareness of local law enforcement, Orange County Sheriff's Office, and I've complimented this policeman, I think it was, I can't remember who it was,
okay,
to be honest with you, but he has the respect of everybody in America. He went out there that night, climbed that fence, and got that bag.
Good for him.
Because he knew how important it was.
Good for him.
I think it was Mellich. I'm not sure.
Okay.
But there again, you have an individual that took it upon himself. He could have just said, go out there tomorrow. I'll send somebody else out there tomorrow.
Yep.
He went out there, got the bag. So now the FBI in their lab has this bag.
So we got a sharp policeman that was smart enough to get this evidence.
Go back out there that night.
Excellent. Now we have an indictment handed down.
Correct.
Murder, manslaughter, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The lawyers are coming forward bias, et cetera, making light of it. The proverbial crap has hit the fan, for lack of a better term. Now it's do or die time. Tim Miller, the salt of the earth, you can't find a better person than Tim Miller, is going to find the body. I agree with you.
Absolutely. And here's what I was talking to the lady that's his right-hand person.
Right.
Mandy. And I've been to a couple of bail conventions where the subject obviously came up. One in Texas and one in Nevada the past 2 weeks. And I've contacted some sureties that were there. They were all present. And I, particularly a gentleman by the name of Fabish, Russell Fabish. He's one of the big players, one of the major players for bail in the state of Florida. And I said, hey, Russell, let's put some money together for Tim to go back out there. Let's let America know that the bail industry isn't just a bunch of bloodsuckers getting people out of jail, that we participate in our communities and social activities and things that are heartfelt.
Right.
And he says, that's a great idea. I talked to Linda Braswell, who personally said she would get involved. She's president of the Professional Bail Association of America, PBUS. I've talked to Bob Sable from a company in Texas. I've talked to several others. They were all a go for funding a resurgence of the search sometime in February, whenever Tim gets ready to go.
That's fantastic.
So I think the people right now are taking the opportunity to say, hey, look, bail's not about just getting somebody out of jail that the public doesn't want out of jail. It's not about some of these things. It's about we're Americans that live in the communities and participate in all these good things, and let us fund Tim, and we will prove to you that we're ready to go.
When you have an organization like Texas EquiSearch, and they're all volunteers who put up their own money and time, and Tim is a crime victim himself with his daughter being murdered, I think it shows a lot for your organization and others to stand up and want to help. Now, I asked you this question last time you were on last week, if you regretted getting involved, but I see this, and you answered yes, sort of, but I see this now as you taking this through right to the end, your thought.
Well, here's the situation. When I still think about it, you know, like, okay, my friend from New York calls and says, hey, Leonard, have you been following? I said, yeah, somewhat. He says, well, let me send you some information. So I called him back the next day, and I said, yeah, it sure looks like your child could be alive, and she's just not reacting to it as if the child's dead. Therefore, that's why she has this non-worried look in her face when she's going to court or the, you know, and things of that nature. And at the time, I thought I was dead on. My associates said, yep, let's go. She's obviously moved the child out of the house. to get away from the parents. They've overparented. I mean, all these thoughts, we talked ourselves into it.
Sure.
Now, I can tell you that I was never, ever, I've had some reverses in my life. But let me tell you, when that Body Farm report from Tennessee came out that Wednesday night and the DNA results from the FBI.
Yeah.
I don't know what I felt, but let me tell you, I don't want to feel that again in the rest of my life. It was a horrible, boy, have you done it this time. I mean, it was the same way one night when I was out there on a Sunday in the rain, and I had no business being out there. Myself, my family, my three kids were going home from Mass. I saw a guy, I jumped out, and I said, hold it. And he turned around, and he had a 45, 6 inches from my face.
Mm-hmm.
And I just stood there and I thought, oh my God, what have you done?
Yeah.
That's exactly how bad I felt when those results came back. Like, what have I done?
But it's instinct. And, you know, Leonard, when you use your instinct and you've been involved in cases for over 30 years, you may have been wrong initially, but I think you're going to be right in the long run.
You know, I was sitting there with Rob, my partner, and I'm saying, Rob, we need an exit strategy. If she ain't cooperating and we've got this information, we got to surrender her.
Yep.
Now, obviously, it was, you know, some people considered it, hey, why are you wussing out? No, we weren't wussing out. It was a situation where we went back there with the idea, and she had said so herself, and even while we were there, I had already contacted the attorney before we went back there. Talk to your client. Will she tell us where the child is? Will she communicate? Will she cooperate? Yes, yes, yes. Will the parents be upset if we get her out of jail? No. Once she was out of jail, everything changed, but we were stuck with her being out of jail.
Mm-hmm.
Until the FBI picked her up on that Friday and said, hey, she's got check charges. Now, is it an excuse to surrender her? No, the surety used what they commonly, you know, they review the bond after the new charges have been filed. It is a thing that the new charges were only $5,000 in bail or whatever it was.
Yep.
Normally, if you have a $10,000 bond and the new bond's $10,000, nobody would question it. But a $500,000 bond and a new bond for $5,000, everybody says, well, why are you surrendering her? It was obvious that the surety said, hey, enough.
Yep.
And that's where we are. And today, enough has been, in other words, enough has been really capitalized on because the judge said no bail now. She's not even eligible. And Shepard Smith said not even a bounty hunter can get her out of jail. He's probably pretty accurate in his assessment. And then we have Todd Bunch coming along, or whatever his name is these days, Todd Bunch, Todd Black,
yep,
coming along and actually admitting that the child is dead.
Yeah, I heard that. Yeah.
And then coming back and wanting to change the words as if somebody in the media was... You know, that's terrible.
Yeah.
That is absolutely terrible when an individual, the media gets beat up on all the time, much like the bail industry, but why would he even consider saying, it was a slip. Sure, because he didn't mean to say that, but he said what he was thinking, and yeah, the child is dead.
Yep, and we usually say what we think when we're right about it, and he was...
Freudian slip is what it's called.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, listen, Leonard, I'm going to let you go because I appreciate your time, and I know that you're busy, but I want to thank you for all the times.
You're quite welcome, and I hope that... that the people in my industry get behind us, and Tim, and sometime in November we get out there and we string 2,000 volunteers a mile long and we walk across that part of Florida and find the child's remains.
I'm going to stay in touch with you, and again, I think it's great what you're doing.
Anytime.
For Texas Equisearch. Thank you.
You bet.
Take care. Bye-bye. That's Leonard Padilla, bounty hunter, and if they can work that out to help Texas Equisearch, the bail industry, I think that's just fantastic. Well, that's it. That's tonight's show. I want to thank Robin Sachs, Catherine Casey, and bail agent, bounty hunter extraordinaire Leonard Padilla, and I think it's just fantastic him going and trying to get some help for Texas Equisearch to get the funding to get back down to Florida to help find Kaylee Anthony, because Kaylee Anthony, who is in a much better place than all of us, I've said that many times, needs to be found. That is so important. Thank you all. We'll see you again real soon here on the Dana Presser Show. Good night.
been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.